Chapter 18. When I unrolled our little piece of patching material to see if it might make a sunshade, I found a small pair of scissors. They were about 4 inches long, blunt-ended, dime store stuff meant for cutting patches. Wrapped in the fabric, they had been protected from the salt water that had ruined our gun. But they weren't much good anyway. "Might come in handy sometime, but I don't know how," I remarked to Tony. He glanced at them apathetically. He raised his hand to brush his long hair out of his eyes, an automatic gesture, and that suddenly gave him an idea. "How about a haircut?" he suggested. "Yeah," Jean said. "It might be cooler." I looked at their tangled mats of hair and fingered my own doubtfully. I didn't think these cheap scissors would make much headway. We had no combs, and our hair was continually falling down over our eyes. It was one of those small annoyances that sometimes bother a man more than much greater things. "Want me to try it on you?" I asked Tony. "Sure, come on," he said. Tony's hair was as stiff as a shaving brush. I sawed away above his forehead, cutting close. When I ended, he was a funny-looking object. He didn't have much beard, just a thin mustache and a few tufts on the end of his chin, which gave him the look of a caricature Mongolian. Jean's beard might be called the scattered type. I cut his hair, too, and then Tony cut mine. The scissors weren't much good for this sort of thing, but at least these crude operations got the hair out of our eyes. We were keeping a sharp watch for coconuts, but we weren't seeing any. We saw a lot of small brownish nuts, about 2 inches long and perhaps 1.5 inches in diameter, that looked like miniature coconuts. "Take a paddle on the starboard side, Jean," I said. "We'll row over and get one of those things." Jean and I, with the shoes on our hands, maneuvered the boat to where I could lean out and pick up one of the nuts. We managed to break one open, but there was nothing fit to eat inside. They weren't nuts at all in the real sense of the word, but just a lot of fiber around a hard core. I think they were the little cones that grow on what the Hawaiians call the hala tree, which is the same as the pandanus. "Shows we're near land anyway," I said. None of us missed the slightest opportunity to feed our optimism. We really believed we were sure to come upon an island, and kept an untiring watch on the horizon for the blue shadow that would be land. Several times we were almost fooled by low cloud banks. I reasoned finally that the type of island we should reach in this vicinity would most likely be pretty flat, whereas the kind that looked from a great distance like clouds would be the mountainous type that was far out of our reach to the north. On the 22nd day, as I recall, we found the log. Time was beginning to run together for us now. One long, blazing day was exactly like another, which makes it difficult to place exactly the small events that interrupted our monotonous routine. We saw the log as a large, dark object that bobbed in the water about 100 yards away. We'd been brooding along, not saying much and hardly thinking. It was too hot. Until the sun went low late in the afternoon, we did little that we didn't have to do. Hours would go by without a word being spoken. There was little one could say that hadn't been said already too many times. Tony spied the log and pointed. "Look," he said. I noted idly that his voice was hoarsening. With some effort, I pushed myself erect by my arms and peered where Tony pointed. Jean, on his knees, leaned on his chest against the gunwale and looked too, shading his eyes with both hands. Tony picked up a shoe, I took the other, and we swung the raft about. With long, labored strokes, we paddled and caught up to the drifting log. It was the whole rotten stump of a tree. I held the raft away from it until I saw that it had no sharp broken-off limbs or other protuberances that might injure the raft. "It's no good," Jean said. "Wait," I said. "Looks like it's got some shellfish or something." The three of us examined the stump closely and found a lot of tiny shellfish of some sort clinging in the decayed crevices. They were very small and resembled clams. They were too minuscule to break open, so we picked them off and popped them into our mouths like berries, chewing them, shell and all. I found a couple of tiny crabs and gobbled them whole. I also discovered 2 tiny oysters, perhaps 1/8 of an ounce of meat. There was no food value to any of the stuff, although I suppose we got a little calcium from the shells of the minute clams, which were soft and easy to chew into moist powder. Finding the log raised our spirits some. We spent a long time picking it over for what we could find, exclaiming and comparing our discoveries. When we finally let it go, the tension of the past few days was broken, and we sang again at prayer meeting that night. We still had the greatest faith in our ability to hold out until we reached an island, and we had not abandoned hope of being picked up by some ship of our own forces. Things hadn't got really bad up to this stage. By now, food was almost our entire theme of conversation. Early morning, late afternoon, and night, Jean and Tony could talk for hours about the different dishes they had eaten and their preferences as cooks. This particular topic was becoming tiresome to me, and I joined in but seldom. Most of the time, I was not enthusiastic about talking, preferring just to sit and watch the waves. I began to feel as if I had been floating forever in a desert of sky and sea, adrift in a blue globe that never changed. I wondered how it would feel again to walk a broad deck. I tried to remember, and it was like reaching for the memory of a story told in childhood, or things half-recollected from a dream. I thought of my wife at Calavo, and of shipmates, and of planes that I had flown, and I thought of the afterlife, and what it would be like to die. I thought of the sea, but not as an enemy. I was unable to personalize so vast a thing. The sea was everything. It was all. It was as big as God. We still had water because we rationed it by sips. In the middle of the day, when the sun was so incredibly hot that we felt as if we were chained beneath a canopy of flame, a taste of water was mighty refreshing. We had had a strong breeze out of the west for some time. Then, on the 25th day, we again had the terrifying experience of a sudden shift of wind, this time from due west to southwest. Noon was overtaking us when the sky began to cloud. Some distance to our left, an ominously rolling mass, almost jet black, appeared in the misty gray, and for the first time we heard thunder. The sea was growing dark and rising uneasily. The black cloud spat a thin stream of electric flame, long, thin, and forked. It darted like a snake's tongue, licking the sea. The burnt air crackled, and the sharp burst of thunder made us jump. The sound seemed to smack on every wave and surround us in diminishing leaps, and finally die unwillingly. The powerful swells were coming faster and dangerously high. The rising wind seemed to be blowing toward the center of the squall, and it whipped the water like an egg beater, driving swift, pointed waves crosswise into the mighty swells which now were towering above our heads. The raft was bouncing like a child's ball on a rubber string. The massive swells pushed us up and up. As they passed beneath, we dropped sickeningly, bobbed in the depths of the trough, and started to rise again with frightening speed. All this time, cross waves were smashing against the gunwales, sending us lurching drunkenly sidewise. Like a great slap in the face, the rain hit. It drove down violently, in solid masses. We couldn't bail for the moment, but huddled together on one side with our backs to the wind and rain, holding the life preservers over our heads with both hands. We found, too late this time, that it didn't pay to sit together, with our weight all on one side. The lighter side was in the air. A wave struck the under edge with a loud boom, and the next instant we were in the water, the raft flying through the air over our heads. I saw a flash of white, our rags for catching water. I let the boys look out for themselves and made a wild grab for the rags. I got both of them as the raft fell back and hit me on the shoulder. It was upside down. The boys didn't have their life jackets on, but since the boat, doing a loop-the-loop, fell right on top of us, it was just a case of grabbing and holding on, while the waves beat us and blinded us and tried to pull us away. I remember being worried about the possibility of sharks. You think of such things automatically. They run through your mind in a way, but you don't realize this until it's all over and the danger is past. It was fairly easy to right the boat this time. We made the wind assist us. The raft was so light that we merely had to raise the side facing into the wind, and the wind swept under and blew it right over, just as it had done a moment ago when we were in it. We were so concerned about getting back into the boat that I don't remember that the effort was particularly exhausting. When we did get in, however, we could do nothing for a few minutes but sit and blow, so evidently there was more exertion than we realized while we were doing it. The full realization of our close call struck us now. Sopping wet, storm-tossed, and still beaten by the rain as if with whips, we shook all over in the nervous reaction. We squatted in the corners of the boat, holding on for our lives, our heads down before the fury of the storm. We had the presence of mind, though, to see that our weight was dispersed, so that the raft would ride as evenly as waves and wind allowed. Thus we rode out the gale and survived our closest brush with death to date. When the rain stopped, we raised our dripping heads and were surprised to see that the clouds had broken, a mile or so away, and the sun was already shining through. The wind dropped instantly, and the sea, while very rough, was no longer in a terrifying frenzy. Nature's quirks are startling and dramatic in the tropics. She's like a spoiled, willful woman. Her moods change violently and to extremes. We stripped off our clothes and cleaned the boat of water by soaking and wringing out our shirts. Tony had no shirt, so he used his trousers. Jean couldn't wring very much, as his hand was still in bad condition from his encounter with the shark. With our clothes wrung almost dry and freshened by the wash, we felt clean again. "Better check the losses," I said. I was considerably worried over what might have gone in the tip-over. I had saved both the water-catching rags. Fortunately, the sea anchor happened to be tied by the line, and it was safe. The other jacket, which I was using for my chart, was lying in the bottom of the boat but hadn't fallen out. It had got wedged into the forward part. Most of the tools were safe in the little tool pocket forward. They had been placed there just in case something like this happened. The can of patching cement also was in the tool pocket. The zippered container of fresh water was buttoned down. There was no danger of losing it. I immediately tasted the water to see if it had been ruined by the submersion. Fortunately, it hadn't, although it had taken on a little more brackishness. The only things we lost were my head rags, the remainder of Tony's shirt, and the hammer we had made from the gun. The sun came out strong and had just dried our clothes when we ran into another brief squall that soaked us through again. Tony was disgusted. "Chief," he said, pulling off his trousers to bail and wring all over again, "it's the little things like this that annoy me.